inspiring conversations with remarkable working women. And today I am really excited to be talking with Jo Lawson, who is the president of Loom Precision Lash. Jo, welcome.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be here. I'm a huge fan of the work that you do.
Oh, thank you. And everything I read about you, I'm a huge fan of you and a huge fan of extensions, eyelash extensions. Actually, I like to extend everything, typically hair, nails, lashes. If I could figure out how to extend myself and make myself taller, that
I'd be up for that also.
So I think I want to talk all about Loom, but before we do, we talk a little bit because my understanding is your career path isn't in the beauty industry, but the tech industry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think my career path probably looks a little bit like a Goofy map when you're kind of watching him travel all around. Because while it's centered mostly on consumer products, consumer experiences, it's been in consumer electronics, it's been in luxury goods, it's been in retail experience, it's been in fintech, it's been in clean tech, and now what I like to call femtech. So kind of applying all the stuff that I've learned across my career and applying it to beauty, which, by the way, is so much fun. People in the beauty industry are a blast, and I'm kind of driven by fun. So kind of having the time of my life right now.
So, well, it sounds like so much fun. Could you just tell us a little bit before we jump in about some of the companies that you've worked at and what you did there in a little more detail?
Yeah. So I started my career after graduate school. I went to a consulting firm, management consulting, which was not really for me. But what it did was it gave me an opportunity to go to my next role, which was at Apple. And interestingly, that was back in 2003. And people were asking me, "What are they still in business?" And I said, "Yes, they are. And they're having fun. So since I'm driven by fun, I'm going to go join these really smart people figuring things out." And I was with Apple for about 9 years. I like to say the most incredible 9 years. It was like a roller coaster ride of just growth and product launches. And just it was quite magical. I first worked on the product marketing team. Then I worked on the retail team and led a global team that grew to about 75 with about 25 contractors. And it was just this incredible experience. I got to travel all over the world, meet incredible customers, and had a remarkable team with remarkable leadership. And it was great. And from there, after Steve died, while he wasn't in my day-to-day, his affect was very much, a truly magical part of the company. And it is still a fantastic company. I just felt like it was time for me to move on about a year after he had passed to go chase other dreams. And so I had gone in with JCPenney, with Ron Johnson, who was also an Apple executive. I then was with Allison Johnson, who was yet another Apple executive who had started her own creative collective. And just kind of was meandering through other careers. I went to Movado, launched their wearable strategy for 7 of their portfolio brands, including, Tommy Hilfiger, Ferrari, Coach, et cetera. And that was a blast, kind of creating, this greenfield space for them. It was before Apple had launched their watch. And then ultimately ended up at a diamond company, which was really based in technology, using nanotechnology to make naturally made diamonds more sparkly, which was kind of fascinating. What earrings. And then just found my way to PayPal and now here. And so, and then to a clean tech company. So all of this is really, I think the common thread was really around building things or fixing things and getting teams, kind of built out and strategies built out across, all of these different types of industries, but predominantly thinking about consumer experience and consumer product. So that's a long answer to your question.
It's great. And you had me at sparkly. So let's talk now about what you do now, which seems like a terrific culmination of everything. Tell us, please, about Loom Precision Lash.
Yeah. So I have been with Loom for about 5 years in an advisory role. And honestly, my goal is to have this be the last job that I have. I'm just having the time of my life. Right now, the engineers have put together this incredible robot that uses AI, computer vision, machine learning, reinforcement learning, and they basically beautifully and gently apply lashes individually to each lash on lash lovers' eyelashes. And we're to a point now where they needed to really think about scaling the business and commercialization. And so that's where I came in. And I think my Apple retail background really was what interested Nate, the co-founder. And he brought me in to just think through what should our consumer experience be. And we're at a point now where I'm just seeing a product market fit like I've never seen before. The amount of interest, the amount of global interest, the size of demand that is already percolating and kind of flying in our front doors has been profound, quite frankly. I've never seen anything like it. And I've been with some pretty impressive companies with some pretty impressive products. So super excited as we're turning the corner now. We are just about to close our Series A, which basically allows us to put our next generation machine out into the wild with a few strategic partners, which is just going to be fantastic.
Because now it's at Ulta, right?
It's been at Ulta for the last, well, since November of last year. Okay. And it was a pilot that got extended to be two or three times longer than it was than we expected. So we are actually just removing it from Ulta yesterday, and we are moving it to a very exciting new partner, which I can't tell you just yet, but somebody very different from Ulta in a very different category of retail. And it just kind of goes to show that because it's such a powerful location-based services, really any retail partner could be, you know, could be wanting this into their channel because it drives footfall, it drives Gen Z traffic, it drives share of wallet, it drives brand affinity, it drives very high value customers who have very high net promoter scores. And so we saw such great results from Ulta. We're excited to plug it into our next strategic partner. So news on that will be coming soon.
So we'll have to come back and tell us. So is this, I see in your marketing materials that the company is based on beauty experience automation. Is that what you would call this? I mean, I would assume.
Yeah, this is definitely beauty experience automation. And the engineers, when they were first building this and testing it on mannequins, they were looking at the patent, the U.S. Patent Office to say, you know, who else is working in this space? And it turns out nobody is working in this space. And so it's allowed us to file six broad categories of patents. We've now been awarded 51 patents in 25 countries. And it's all about this notion that there's a lot of things that you can do that are very tedious and on the hairy edge of even human capability. And so these robots can do them beautifully, but women also enjoy the experience of going to a spa and feeling pampered. So we're leveraging the technology to take the tedium out of the job, and then we're letting them focus on, in this case, their lash artistry. But with our patents, there's a ton of automation that we could do around eyebrows, tanning, tattoos. I mean, you can imagine, you know, all the things that a robot might actually do better than a human. And I feel like, you know, when you look at the way a lash artist applies lashes today, they're literally leaning on your forehead with razor sharp instruments, in some cases breathing on you, separating every eyelash with these instruments that are a millimeter from your face. And I often look at these videos and think, what could possibly go wrong? And this is the gold standard. And as you said, your lash artist is amazing. And there are many, many amazing lash artists, but many of them have to quit their careers early because they just can't stay in that position for 8-10 hours a day, day after day, month after month, year after year. And so what we want to do is just take that, the hardest part of their work away, leaving them with the part that's the more fun, the connecting with within clients, the finishing touches, the artistry.
So I have to ask, so is the artist still involved? And I ask that, you know, having just come back from the, oh, look at that. My lashes are sticking together as we speak. Perhaps if they have been done by a robot. No, but you know, one of the main conversations at the Cannes Lions Festival, which is all about creativity and advertising branding, is what is the need for creative directors moving forward if AI is coming in to replace so many creative directors? And what the conversation really went to was, but you'll still need people to understand storytelling and emotion, and that's the place for them. In this case, is the goal eventually to completely replace all these people that are doing the lashes, and then, as you say, you know, eyebrows and tattoos, or to help them as a tool?
I think we look at it as technology in service of humans. So really using it as the best tool they would ever have. And the reason is because when you come into a lash studio, and by the way, we about 64% of the women that we lashed with Ulta had never been lashed before. So we're basically increasing the addressable market and actually creating access to an addressable market that didn't exist before, because either they were afraid or they didn't know what to expect. And for some reason, you know, putting in a robot feels cleaner, safer, faster, and more consistent, which, oh, by the way, it is. But we always need the lash artist, because at the beginning of the experience, you're talking about, you know, what look do you want to have? How long do you want your lashes? How thick do you want your lashes? And that kind of thing. So you need the human contact for that. Then you also, as you know, they tape down your lower lashes and then they prep your eyes to accept the lashes. And so our lash artists do exactly that same thing. And then and then they're managing the robot to just make sure that the robot is actually achieving the look that you want it to achieve. And then after that, you know, when you're done, they just look to make sure, are there any finishing touches? Is there anything else that the client would like to just make it pop a little bit differently or a little more density here or there? So we do need them. I suppose in years to come, you know, years down the road, maybe we'll need them less and less, but by then they'll be integral partners in our business anyway. So, you know, we still need somebody running the machine. They may do less artistry and more other things. I mean, and I think I might've mentioned this, but we've literally had lash artists say to us, you know, you've taken away my job, but you gave me a career. And to me, that's really powerful. I mean, one of our investors is actually a friend of mine. And she said, my only problem is that I don't ever want to take a woman's job away, because there's a lot of women who make good money in this industry. And I assuaged her concerns because I said, there's no world where I would even want to be a leader in this organization if I felt like I was robbing women of jobs, or really anybody of jobs. But what we're doing is we're creating an environment that they can actually have a career out of this and see way more clients, which means translates into more money in their pocket. And so I had another friend that worked at Apple that I worked for, and she always talked about technology in the service of humanity. And I struggled with it because there's a lot of examples where I feel like it takes a little bit of our humanity away, and AI is accused of this type of possibility all the time. But I feel like this is that really kind of quirky, weird niche thing that has a huge amount of possibility from a revenue perspective, but also truly does help people in their job with the tool and helps clients get done instead of 2 or 3 hours in 30 minutes. So it kind of gives back in a lot of unexpected ways.
No, I love the idea of being able to build a more of a career than just the task part of it, but more the artistry part of it. And in that vein, you talked about this a little bit, but I wonder if you could elaborate some of the other places that AI could help in the artistry of women's beauty.
Well, I mean, there's clockwork, which basically does your fingernails. So there's pen, which actually does the whole manicure. So I think clockwork focuses on just your polish, which is kind of interesting. And then 10 or 10 Beauty, I think it's called, literally is working on the entire manicure. There's a robot right now that's doing called Black Dot, that's doing tattoos with the kind of precision that you can literally have the Mona Lisa tattooed on your arm and it looks like Da Vinci rose from the dead and put little needles in your arm. So it's just, you know, there's just a lot going on around that. But even with that, it's kind of been a slow. You think about how tech is influencing so many other categories of business, and beauty, it feels like, has been kind of the last to get like physical, mechanical things involved with it, because it is a very human to human moment that I think women in particular, and men too, turns out we're actually lashing a growing number of men, which I found very surprising. 1 week we had 3 men at Ulta. That was a record. And so I do think that, you know, it's going to be important for all of these companies and us as we grow and, you know, think about moving into other categories of beauty, that we always make sure that the experience doesn't lose its magic touch. I mean, and that's, I think, why the co-founders really wanted me to participate, because, you know, much like the Genius Bar at Apple, we're trying to create the lash artists are going to be the hero of Loom. They're going to be where, you know, who touches the customer, literally physically touches the customer and helps the client through the journey. And for those that are new, to this, you know, teaching them that this is actually safer than humans and showing them the safety protocols, et cetera. So it's just, I think we can never lose sight of the fact that these are still need to be curated moments that women need to love to enjoy.
Yeah. It sounds fantastic. So what then, you mentioned a lot of expansion. What are some of the expansion plans? Not any of the places, you can't talk about them yet, but what are some of the expansion plans that Loom is looking to do?
Yeah, I mean, because we drive such consistent and repeat foot traffic, you can imagine a world where there's any retailer, one of their biggest issues is foot traffic, you know, basically also Gen Z, making sure you're getting the next generation of buyers into your studios or into your retail experiences. Those are the kinds of retail locations that are ripe for something like this. So imagine, you know, of course, there's the beauty brands, there's the med spas, there's even things like ophthalmologists who want to own this kind of space on a woman's or on a customer's face. And then you think about, well, there's also travel. And women go on vacation and like to get pampered at salons and in hotels. And then there's lifestyle brands like, you know, like Lululemon or Equinox, you know, and Equinox just put in Escape, which is the robotic massage company, which is amazing. And so, you know, you start thinking about that. And there's a lot of divergent thinking that can go into that process, which is what we're in the middle of right now. And then you can kind of converge on what are those strategic partners that really could be a feather, that we could be a feather in their cap and they could be a feather in our cap, and just really, you know, grow the pie, grow the revenue, and drive a lot of traffic to our robots.
So let's shift away a little bit, because I want to put a few things together and ask you some questions in terms of career, because, mm-hmm. you know, it sounds like you were able to take your skills together. You had an opportunity in what sounds like a fantastically fun field and also highly lucrative and move into it. And, you know, talking about people being worried about AI or not worried about AI really doesn't matter, because here happening, going to keep happening. So do you have advice for somebody who has a lot of different skills and sees what's happening in the market and, you know, in business and wants to be a part of this, but may not have those exact skills or may also not be 27 years old? What do they do?
Yeah. Yeah, that's such an important topic. You know, we probably all have a lot of friends who are in some sort of transition, because it feels like the last 4 or 5 years have been very tempestuous, career-wise, health-wise, geopolitical, you know, macroeconomic. There's just so much going on. And it does feel harder now. To me, it seems there's a sense that it's harder now to find something. I would just say, you know, you can't be afraid of, I mean, you can be afraid, but you have to be brave. you have to learn about AI, particularly if you have an industry that you love, whether you're staying in the industry that you're in, or you're even thinking about migrating to a new industry. And we can talk about that in a minute. But I think you have to embrace what AI could become in that space and lean into it. Just be understanding it so that you know what is your special magic that you can bring to what AI can't deliver. Like you talked a little bit about the creative world. And I think you say that's beautiful, that, you know, the storytelling, the context, the things that you need a human to really deliver. And, you know, over time that may shift too, but I think you have to kind of meet the moment, let your fear aside, be brave, learn about it, and then kind of think what makes you, what's your superpower in that context. And then when it comes to transitioning industries, I mean, I've accidentally been an expert at this. You know, I look back and I'm like, wait, how did I end up at first of all, how did I end up at Apple? Then how did I end up in a fintech? And then how did I end up in a clean tech? You know, and it so much of it is making sure that you can position yourself as a resource who can solve problems broadly in your category of excellence and, you know, training and experience. But also, I cannot underestimate how important the network that I've created in my life has really, I've got one job that didn't come from my network, and all of the jobs that I have, it's one job. And I remember when this co-founder asked me to lead his company, I'm like, how did you find me? And he said, LinkedIn. And I was like, well, okay, well, that's my network too. So in a way, every job I've ever had is that. And so I feel like you never underestimate the value of a network. And the thing is you can't build a network when you're desperate to have a network and you just need to activate it. No, you need to, it's something that you nurture long-term and over time. And part of, I think, a network is always offering what you can to others and being a resource for other people when you can, even when you feel like you're in your time of need. Sometimes that's when you can be the most generous because you have nothing to lose, right? So I just think that those are just kind of a few little things that have really helped me. And, you know, there was one point where I took a 1-year sabbatical. Part of it was by choice and part of it wasn't by choice. And so how do you navigate that and then market that on your website? Well, I choose to say this was a privileged time where I got to be more philanthropic. I got to travel. I got to dream more. And those are all important jobs too, as a professional and as a personal, as a way to just kind of drive yourself personally so that you don't feel like you're kind of stymied.
I love everything that you said there. And there's one thing in particular, I'm not going to use the word unpack because I'm trying to stay away from all these silly business terms, but that I just want to go back to, because I think a lot of times younger people, people that work with me at my firm, they are very hung up on network and they get confused on what networking really can be. And I think a lot of it, and please tell me if you agree with me, is just making sure to stay in touch with the people that you know and that you actually genuinely like and you find useful. And as you said, help them if you can, let them know what you need if you can, and be a genuine friend or a genuine contact to them, as opposed to some of this sort of faux networking that really doesn't ever get you anywhere anyway.
No, I think that's exactly right. And it's also not just showing up for a beer at like your alumni event. I mean, that's also kind of fun and important. But like when you meet somebody, if you've got the privilege to meet them, you know, whether it's even following up through LinkedIn with a message saying, hey, I noticed you launched a book. I can't wait to buy it. And it, like, kudos to you for, you know, putting it out, like little things like that just go a long way to making, and even saying, you know, how can I help you, you know, get it into my, you know, if you happen to be in India, for example, I have a few women that I am mentoring in India, you know, what can you offer them that would otherwise they'd never have no access to an Indian influencer, for example. So, you know, I just think there's ways to be creative. The other thing that I think people forget is executives. I mean, it can be pretty lonely at the top of a company because everybody's either afraid of you or intimidated by you or just think you're too busy. So oftentimes I feel like just saying thank you and good job and, you know, I'm watching you, I'm rooting for you, like your leadership is inspiring. Things like that matter so much. And people remember because, I mean, as, you know, the saying goes, people remember how you make them feel, you know, and that strikes a feeling of, you know, of warmth towards a person who's actually paying attention and is saying something without asking for anything. So then when you do need to say, hey, you know, could you help me out here? You know, they have context for who you are and why you matter in their life.
Yeah.
And they can help you in a more authentic way, which will be a bigger help to you than they could if they just passed you along because you asked them to with no context.
I was too enthusiastic because I just want to say that is such good advice too. I mean, you're absolutely right on all of that. And then in the same vein of advice, although you've already given us a lot of very good advice, could you please, we just sort of wrap this up with, is there one piece of advice that has really helped you in your life and your career that you please share with
me? I would say finding people who respect and value you is the most important thing you can do for yourself. You will work harder than you've ever worked for people like that. You'll have more fun with people like that. And you'll work in a way that doesn't even feel like work. So for me, I mean, I remember when I went to Apple and people were like, are they still in business? And I said, yeah, they're smart and they're having fun. Like I'm going over there, you know? And, you know, it changed my world. And ultimately, you know, Apple has changed the world in a lot of different ways. But I just feel like if you can surround yourself with people who respect you and value your contribution, it will not feel like work. And you will just bounce up and up and up. And then you can help others. You can bring others along with you.
A perfect place to end. You're definitely doing that. Thank you so much for talking to us.
It was my pleasure, Katie.